At one point they were caught between two volleys of shot and copped the volley from the field gun en batterie, which the gunners, not having any orders, had kept firing without interruption. The intrepid and imprudent Fannicot was one of those who died in the sale of grapeshot. He was killed by the cannon, that is, by order. This attack, which was more furious than serious, angered Enjolras. "The idiots," he said, "they're getting their men killed and using up our ammunition for nothing." Enjolras spoke like the true riot general he was. Insurrection and its repression do not fight on equal terms. Insurrection, promptly exhaustible, has only a limited number of shots to fire and only a limited number of combatants to lose. An emptied cartridge pouch, a man down, can't be replaced. Repression, having the army, does not count men, and having Vincennes does not count shots. Repression has as many regiments as the barricade has men, and as many arsenals as the barricade has cartridge boxes. And so they are struggles of 1 against 100, which always end in the crushing of the barricades, unless revolution, suddenly rearing up, comes and throws its flaming archangel's blade into the balance. This does happen. Then there is a general uprising. The streets start to boil over. Popular redoubts proliferate. All Paris ripples with an intense thrill. The quid divinum is unleashed. An August 10th is in the air. A July 29th is in the air. A wondrous light appears. The yawning maw of force backs away, and the army, that lion, sees in front of it, steady on its feet and tranquil, that prophet, France. Passing Glimmers. In the chaos of feelings and passions that go into defending a barricade, there's a bit of everything. There's bravery, youth, honor, enthusiasm, idealism, conviction, the relentlessness of the gambler, and especially flashes of hope. One of these flashes, one of these faint stirrings of hope, suddenly ran through the barricade of the Rue de la Chanvrerie at the most unexpected moment. "Listen," Enjolras, still on the watch, suddenly cried, "it seems to me that Paris is waking up." It is undeniable that for an hour or two on the morning of June 6th, the insurrection experienced a certain upswing. The obstinacy of the Saint-Merry tocsin rekindled a few vague urges. In the Rue du Poirier and the Rue de Gravilliers, barricades got underway. In front of the Port Saint-Martin, a young man armed with a carbine attacked a cavalry squadron single-handedly. Out in the open, in the middle of the boulevard, he went down on one knee, raised his weapon to his shoulder, fired, killed the captain of the squadron, and turned on his heel, quipping, "There's another one who won't do us any more harm." He was promptly run through with a saber. In the Rue Saint-Denis, a woman fired on the municipal guard from behind a lowered Venetian blind. At each shot you could see the slats of the blind quivering. A 14-year-old boy was stopped in the Rue de la Cossonnerie with his pockets full of cartridges. Several posts were attacked. At the entrance to the Rue Bertin-Poiret, an extremely lively and completely unpredictable fusillade greeted a regiment of cuirassiers, at the head of which marched General Cavaignac de Beragne. In the Rue Planche-Mibray, they hurled shards of old crockery and household utensils at the troops from the rooftops. This was a bad sign, and when the incident was reported to Maréchal Soult, Napoleon's old lieutenant became dreamy, remembering Suchet's Saragossa dictum, "We're finished when the old women empty their chamber pots on our heads." These general symptoms, presenting just when the riot was thought to be contained, this outbreak of angry fever gaining the upper hand again, these sparks flying around here and there above the dense masses of combustible material known as the Faubourg of Paris, all this taken together worried the top brass. They rushed to put out the fire before it spread. They delayed the attack on the Maubuée, Le Chanvrerie, and Saint-Marie barricades until the crackling flames could be put out, so as to have nothing else to tackle but those three, and to be able to finish them in one go. Columns were sent out into the fermenting streets, sweeping the main ones, sounding out the small ones right and left, sometimes slowly and cautiously, other times charging along. The troops broke down the doors of houses from which there had been firing. At the same time, cavalry maneuvers dispersed the throngs on the boulevards. This repression was not accomplished without noise, without that tumultuous racket peculiar to clashes between the army and the people. This was exactly what Enjolras had picked up in the intervals between the cannonade and the musketry. On top of that, he had seen wounded men going past the end of the street on stretchers, and he said to Courfeyrac, "Those wounded men aren't ours." Hope did not last long. The glimmer quickly dimmed. In less than half an hour, what was in the air had evaporated. It was like lightning without the thunder, and the insurgents again felt crushed by that sort of lead weight that the indifference of the people drops on deserted diehards. The general movement that seemed to have been vaguely taking off had aborted, and the attention of the Minister of War and the strategy of the generals could now focus on the three or four barricades still standing. The sun rose on the horizon. An insurgent called out to Enjolras, "We're hungry here. Are we really going to die like this without eating?" Enjolras, still leaning on his battlement, and without taking his eyes off the end of the street, nodded his head in the affirmative. In which you will read the name of Enjolras' mistress. Courfeyrac, sitting on a paving stone next to Enjolras, continued to abuse the cannon, and every time that gloomy cloud of projectiles known as grapeshot passed with its monstrous noise, he greeted it with an outburst of irony. "You're wearing your lungs out, you poor old brute. You worry me. You're wasting your breath. That's not thunder, that's a cough." And those around him chuckled. Courfeyrac and Bossuet, whose valiant good humor grew with the danger, swapped jokes instead of food, like Madame Scarron, and since wine was lacking, poured good cheer all round. "I have to hand it to Enjolras," said Bossuet. "His imperturbable temerity stuns me. He lives alone, which makes him perhaps a little sad. Enjolras moans about the greatness that keeps him single. The rest of us all more or less have mistresses that drive us mad, in other words, make us brave. When you're as lovesick as a tiger, the least you can do is fight like a lion. It's a way of getting our own back for the tricks our little grisettes play on us. Roland gets himself killed to rile Angélique. All our acts of heroism derive from our women. A man without a woman is like a pistol without a hammer. It's women that get men fired up. But, well, Enjolras doesn't have a woman. He's not lovesick, yet he still finds a way to be intrepid. It's unheard of that you can be as cold as ice and as bold as fire." Enjolras did not look as though he was listening, but if anyone had been close to him, they would have heard him mutter in an undertone, "Patria." Bossuet was still laughing when Courfeyrac cried out, "Here's something new." And putting on the voice of a court crier, he added, "I'm known as 8-pounder." Indeed, a new character had just entered the stage. It was a second piece of ordnance. The gunners rapidly maneuvered this second piece into position en batterie next to the first. This was the beginning of the end. A few moments later, the two guns, swiftly served, fired straight at the redoubt. The fire of the platoon of the line and of the suburbs supported the artillery. Another cannonade could be heard some distance away. At the same time as the two guns were relentlessly battering the redoubt in the Rue de la Chanvrerie, two other pieces of ordnance, one positioned on the Rue Saint-Denis, the other on the Rue Aubry-le-Boucher, were peppering the barricade Saint-Marie. The four cannons echoed each other dolefully. The barking of those dour dogs of war was like calling and answering. One of the two guns now battering the barricade in the Rue de la Chanvrerie was firing grapeshot and the other cannonballs. The gun firing cannonballs was pointed a little high, and the angle of fire was calculated so that the cannonball struck the rim of the upper ridge of the barricade, flattened it, and scattered the shattered cobblestones over the insurgents in bursts of shot. This process was meant to drive the combatants off the top of the redoubt and force them to huddle together inside it. In other words, it heralded the main assault. Once the combatants were driven from the top of the barricade by the cannonballs and from the windows of the tavern by the grapeshot, the attacking columns could risk entering the street without being targeted, perhaps even without being seen, swiftly scale the redoubt, as they had done the night before, and, who knows, perhaps take it by surprise. "We absolutely must do something about those guns," said Enjolras, and he shouted, "Open fire on the gunners!" Everyone was ready. The barricade, which had remained silent for so long, opened fire wildly. 7 or 8 discharges followed each other in a fit of rage and jubilation. The street filled with blinding smoke, and after a few minutes, through this fog all streaked with flames, 2/3 of the gunners could vaguely be made out lying under the wheels of the guns. Those who had remained standing continued to serve the guns with rigid composure, but the firing had slackened its pace. "This is working well," said Bossuet to Enjolras. "Success!" Enjolras shook his head and replied, "Another 15 minutes of such success, and there won't be 10 cartridges left in the barricade." It would seem that Gavroche heard this remark. Gavroche outside. Courfeyrac suddenly saw someone at the foot of the barricade, outside, in the street, under the rain of cannonballs. Gavroche had taken a bottle carrier from the tavern, had gone out through the exit, and was busy quietly emptying into his carrier the full cartridge pouches of the National Guards who had been killed on the talus of the redoubt. "What are you doing out there?" said Courfeyrac. Gavroche stuck his nose up. "Citizen, I'm filling my carrier." "Can't you see the grape shot?" Gavroche replied. "So it's raining, what of it?" Courfeyrac yelled, "Get back!" "Presently," said Gavroche, and he bounded into the street. You will recall that in falling back, the Fannicot Company had left behind them a trail of corpses. 20 dead lay strewn about here and there, over the pavement, all the way down the street. 20 cartridge pouches for Gavroche, a supply of cartridges for the barricade. The smoke was as thick as fog in the street. Anyone who has seen a cloud fall into a mountain gorge between 2 sheer cliff faces can imagine what the smoke was like, how compressed it was, and how seemingly thickened by the 2 gloomy rows of tall houses. It rose slowly and was endlessly topped up, hence a gradual darkening that turned even broad daylight a dense white. The combatants could hardly see each other from one end of the street to the other, even though the street was very short. This obscurity, probably intentional and calculated by the army chiefs who were supposed to be directing the assault on the barricade, was useful to Gavroche. Under the folds of this veil of smoke, and thanks to his smallness, he was able to advance a fair way into the street without being seen. He robbed 7 or 8 cartridge pouches without much danger. He crawled along on his stomach, galloped on all fours, holding his carrier in his teeth, twisted, slid, wriggled, snaked from one dead body to the next, and emptied each cartridge pouch or cartridge box the way a monkey opens a nut. From the barricade, which he was still fairly close to, no one dared yell out to him to come back, for fear of calling attention to him. On one body, which was that of a corporal, he found a powder horn. "In case of thirst," he said, ramming it in his pocket. Forging ever onward, he came to the point where the fog from the fusillade became transparent, so much so that the skirmishers from the suburbs, massed at the corner of the street, suddenly pointed out to each other this thing stirring in the smoke. Just as Gavroche was divesting a sergeant lying over a curbstone of his cartridges, a bullet struck the corpse. "Well, I never," said Gavroche. "Now they're killing my dead on me." A second bullet made the pavement next to him glitter with sparks. A third knocked over his carrier. Gavroche peered around and saw that it was coming from the suburbans at the end of the street. He scrambled to his feet and stood erect, with his hair to the wind, his hands on his hips, and his eyes fixed on the National Guards that were shooting. He sang, "They're ugly in Nanterre, that's the fault of Voltaire, and dumb in Palaiseau, that's the fault of Rousseau." Then he picked up his carrier, put back in the cartridges that had fallen out, without losing a single one, and, advancing toward the fusillade, went and stripped another cartridge pouch. There, a fourth bullet also missed him. Gavroche sang, "I'm not the Lord Mayor, that's the fault of Voltaire. I'm only a sparrow, that's the fault of Rousseau." A fifth bullet only succeeded in dragging a third verse out of him. "Joy is my nature, that's the fault of Voltaire. Misery is my trousseau, that's the fault of Rousseau." This went on for some little time. The spectacle was horrifying and mesmerizing. Gavroche shot at was taunting the shooting. He looked like he was really enjoying himself. It was the sparrow pecking at the hunters. He responded to each discharge with a verse. They went on firing at him, and they went on missing him. The National Guards and the soldiers laughed as they aimed at him. He lay down, then got up. He hid in a doorway, then leaped out, disappeared, reappeared, ran away, came back, responded to the volley of grapeshot by thumbing his nose, and meanwhile looted cartridges, emptied cartridge pouches, and filled his pannier. The insurgents, breathless with anxiety, followed him with their eyes. The barricade trembled. He sang. This was not a child. It was not a man. It was a strange, fairy larrikin. You would have said the invulnerable dwarf of the melee. The bullets chased him, but he was nimbler than they were. Like Roger the Dodger, he was playing some frightening private game of hide-and-seek with Diff. Every time the pug-nosed face of the spectre came close, the gamin gave him the flick. One bullet, though, better aimed or more treacherous than the others, ended up hitting the will-o'-the-wisp child. They saw Gavroche totter, then he crumpled. The whole barricade let out a cry, but there was something of Antaeus in this pygmy. For a gamin to hit the pavement is like a giant hitting the ground. Gavroche had only fallen the better to rise again. He stayed sitting there on his haunches, and, with a long trickle of blood streaking his face, he lifted up both arms in the air, turned his head to where the bullet had come from, and began singing. I fell from the air. That's the fault of Voltaire. Nose in gutter, though. That's the fault of... He did not finish. A second bullet from the same sniper cut him off. This time he fell face first onto the pavement and did not stir again. That great little soul had taken wing. How you go from being a brother to a father. At that very moment in the Luxembourg Gardens, for the eye of the drama must be everywhere at once, there were two little boys holding each other by the hand. One of them could have been 7 years old, the other 5. Having been soaked by the rain, they were walking along the paths on the sunny side, the older one leading the little one. They were pale and in rags, and they looked like wild birds. The little one said, I'm really hungry. The older boy, already a bit protective, pulled his brother along by the left hand and held a stick in his right. They were alone in the garden. The garden was empty, the gates were closed as a police measure in response to the insurrection. The troops that had bivouacked there had been called away by the requirements of combat. How did the boys get there? Perhaps they had escaped from some unlocked guardhouse. Perhaps somewhere in the neighborhood, at the Barrière d'Enfer, or on the esplanade of the Observatoire, or in the neighboring square overlooked by the pediment, on which you can read, In venerunt parvulum, panis involutum, there were some run-down booth set up by street players that they had run away from. Perhaps the night before they had managed to evade the garden keepers at closing time and had spent the night in one of those huts where people sit around reading the newspapers. The fact is that they were wandering around like strays, apparently on their own. Wandering around like a stray, apparently on your own, means you are lost. These poor little boys were, in fact, lost. The two boys were the same two boys Gavroche had gone to some trouble over, and that the reader will recall. Children of the Thénardiers, rented out to Mother Magnon, attributed to Monsieur Gillenormand, and now leaves dropped by all those rootless trees and tumbled along the ground by the wind. Their clothes, clean in the days of Mother Magnon, that had served her as a prospectus in regard to Monsieur Gillenormand, had turned to tatters. These little creatures now belonged to the statistics of abandoned children, children that the police report pick up, mislay, and find once more on the streets of Paris. It took the mayhem of such a day for the two miserable little waifs to end up in the gardens. If the wardens had spotted them, they'd have chased the ragamuffins away. Poor kids are not allowed in public gardens, yet people ought to reflect that they too, like all children, have a right to flowers. These two were there thanks to the gates being shut. They were breaking the law. They had sneaked into the gardens and stayed there. Closed gates do not mean the keepers are suddenly off duty. Surveillance is meant to continue. But it slackens off and takes a nap, and the keepers themselves, stirred up by the general public anxiety and more concerned about what was happening outside than inside, had stopped watching the garden and had not spotted the two tiny delinquents. It had rained the night before, and even a little that morning. But in June, downpours are of no account. You hardly notice, an hour after a storm, that the beautiful bright day earlier shed tears. In summer, the ground dries as fast as a child's cheek. At around the time of the summer solstice, the light at the height of noon is piercing, so to speak. It gobbles up everything, it applies itself to the ground, and smothers it in a sort of suction action. It is as though the sun is thirsty. A shower is a glass of water, rain is immediately drunk. In the morning, everything was streaming. In the afternoon, everything is shining in a powdery haze. Nothing is as wonderful as green foliage washed by the rain and dried by the sun. It is like freshness served hot. Gardens and meadows, with water in their roots and sunshine in their flowers, turn into incense burners and smolder away, releasing all their perfumes at once. Everything laughs and sings and offers itself. You feel sweetly drunk. Spring is a taste of paradise. The sun helps human beings to bide their time. There are those who ask for nothing more, living beings who, having bright blue skies above, say, "This is enough." Dreamers absorbed in wonder, drawing from nature worship and indifference to good and bad. Contemplators of the cosmos, radiantly distracted from mankind, who just don't understand how anybody can worry about the hunger of some, the thirst of others, the nakedness of the poor in winter, about the lymphatic curvature of a tiny spine, about the straw pallet, about the garret, the dungeon, and the rags of shivering young girls, when a person can just dream away idly under the trees, peaceful and terrible souls, mercilessly content. The funny thing is, the infinite is enough for them. That great need of mankind's, the finite, which allows itself to be embraced, is something they know nothing about. The finite, which allows that sublime travail, progress, is not something they ever think about. The indefinite, which is born of the half-human, half-divine combination of the infinite and the finite, escapes them. Provided they are face to face with immensity, they smile. Never joy, always ecstasy. To lose themselves is what they live for. For them, the history of humanity is a mere cadastral survey. The all is not in it. The true all remains beyond it. What's the point of worrying about that minor detail, man? Man suffers, that's possible, but just look at Aldebaran on the rise. The mother has no more milk. The newborn baby dies. I know nothing about that, but just look at this marvelous rosette made by a slice of fir tree examined under the microscope. What's the most beautiful Malines lace compared to that? These thinkers forget to love. The zodiac is such a big thing for them that it prevents them from seeing the child crying. God eclipses their souls. This is a family of minds, at once both small and great. Horace was one of them, Goethe was another. La Fontaine, perhaps. Magnificent egoists of the infinite, unruffled onlookers of pain, who don't see Nero if the weather's nice. People for whom the sun hides the stake, who would gladly watch the guillotine at work in order to study some effect of light in it, who hear neither the cry, nor the sob, nor the death rattle, nor the tocsin, for whom everything is fine since the month of May exists. People who, as long as there are clouds of purple and gold above their heads, declare themselves satisfied and are determined to be happy until the stars stop shining and the birds stop singing. These are the darkly radiant. They have no idea they are to be pitied. Of course they are. Whoever does not weep does not see. We have to admire them and pity them, as you would pity and admire anyone who is at once both night and day, with no eyes beneath their eyebrows but a star, instead in the middle of their forehead. The indifference of such thinkers is, according to some, a superior philosophy. So be it. But this brand of superiority is a little wobbly. You can be immortal and lame. Witness Vulcan. You can be more than man and less than man. The immense incomplete exists in nature. Who knows whether the sun isn't a blind man? But then, heavens, who can you trust? Solum quis dicere, falsum audeat. So certain geniuses themselves, certain almighty human beings, star men, might actually get things wrong? That which sits up there at the top, at the summit, at the zenith, that which pours so much light over the earth, might actually see little, see badly, see not at all? Isn't this cause for despair? No. But what is above the sun, then? God. On June 6, 1832, at around 11 o'clock in the morning, solitary and empty of people, the Luxembourg was lovely. The quincunxes and parterres sent each other balms and dazzling displays through the light. The branches of trees, wild in the midday brightness, seemed to be trying to embrace each other. Warblers were making a racket in the sycamores, sparrows were triumphant, woodpeckers were climbing right up the chestnut trees, giving little taps of their beaks in holes in the bark. The flower beds accepted the legitimate royalty of the lilies. The most noble of perfumes is the perfume given off by whiteness. You breathed in the peppery smell of pinks. The old crows of Marie de Médicis were amorous in the great trees. The sun lit up the tulips and turned them gold and crimson, tulips being nothing more than every variety of flame made flower. All around the tulip beds, the bees whirled, sparks from the flame flowers. Everything was grace and gaiety, even the impending rain. That recidivist which the lilies of the valley and the honeysuckles would lap up was not at all off-putting. The swallows were flying low, sweetly menacing. Whoever was around inhaled happiness. Life smelled good. All of this nature gave off candor, succor, support, fatherliness, tenderness, a golden yellow freshness of dawn. The thoughts falling from the sky were as soft as a little child's hand when you kiss it. The statues under the trees, naked and white, had frocks of shade riddled with light. These goddesses were all in tatters of sunshine. Sunbeams hung from them on all sides. Around the great pond, the ground was already so dry again it was almost burnt. There was enough wind to raise little riots of dust here and there. A few yellow leaves, left over from the previous autumn, merrily chased each other like gamins playing. The abundance of light had something indescribably reassuring about it. Life, sap, heat, fragrance spilled over. You could feel the hugeness of the spring underlying creation. In all these puffs of air, saturated with love, in this to-ing and fro-ing of reverberations and reflections, in this wildly extravagant spree of sunbeams, in this endless outpouring of liquid gold, you could feel the prodigality of the inexhaustible. And behind this splendor, as behind a curtain of flame, you caught a glimpse of God, that millionaire in stars. Thanks to the sand, there was not a trace of mud. Thanks to the rain, there was not a speck of ash. The bouquets of flowers had just had a wash. All the velvets, all the satins, all the enamels, all the golds that come from out of the ground in the form of flowers were impeccable. This magnificence was clean. The great silence of happy nature filled the gardens. A celestial silence compatible with a thousand different melodies, the cooing of nests, the buzzing of swarms, the palpitations of the wind. All the harmony of the season came together in a gracious whole. Spring's entrances and exits were taking place in the desired order. The lilacs were nearly finished, The jasmine was starting to come out. Some flowers were late, some insects early. The vanguard of the red butterflies of June were fraternizing with the rear guard of the white butterflies of May. The plane trees were getting new skins. The breeze was carving waves in the magnificent hugeness of the chestnut trees. It was splendid. A veteran of the neighboring barracks, peering through the fence, said, "Here's spring in full dress, shouldering arms." All of nature was breakfasting. Creation was at table. It was time. The great blue tablecloth had been laid over the sky, and the great green tablecloth over the ground. The sun shone a giorno. God was serving the universal meal. Every being had its food or its fodder. The wood pigeon found hemp seed. The chaffinch found millet. The goldfinch found chickweed. The robin redbreast found worms. The bee found flowers. The fly found infusoria. The greenfinch found flies. Of course, they all took a bite of each other, which is the mystery of the mixing of bad with good. But not one creature had an empty stomach. The two little abandoned boys had almost got as far as the big pond, but they were a bit overwhelmed by all this light, and they tried to hide, an instinct of the poor and weak in the face of magnificence, even when impersonal. They ducked behind the swan's shelter and stayed there. Now and then, at intervals, when the wind came on, you could vaguely hear cries, a noise, a sort of tumultuous jangling, which was gunfire, and dull knocking sounds, which were cannon blasts. There was smoke over the rooftops around Les Halles. A bell, which seemed to be calling, was ringing far away in the distance. The boys did not seem to hear these sounds. The little one repeated in a small voice from time to time, "I'm hungry." Almost at the same moment as the boys, another pair approached the great pond. This was a burgher of about 50, leading by the hand a burgher of about 6, no doubt a father with his son. The burgher of 6 was holding a big brioche. In those days, certain houses near the park, in the Rue Madame and the Rue d'Enfer, had keys to the Luxembourg, which the residents used when the gates were closed, a special dispensation since done away with. This father and son duo no doubt came from one of those houses. The two little boys saw the gentleman coming and hid a bit more. The man was a bourgeois. The same one, perhaps, that Marius in his lovesick state had heard one day advising his son to avoid excess at this same great pond. He had an affable and high-minded air and a mouth that, never shut, was always smiling. This mechanical smile, produced by too much jaw and too little skin, bears the teeth more than the soul. The child, with his brioche that he had mauled but not finished, looked stuffed. He was decked out as a National Guard because of the riot, and the father had stayed decked out as a bourgeois because of prudence. Father and son had stopped at the pond, where the two swans were frolicking. The bourgeois seemed to have a special admiration for the swans. He resembled them in the sense that he walked just like them. For the moment, the swans were swimming, which is their principal talent, and they were superb. If the two poor little boys had listened and been old enough to understand, they would have been able to reap the words of a grave man. The father was saying to his son, "The wise man lives content with little. Look at me, son. I don't go in for pomp. You never see me with coats spangled with gold brocade or bedizened with precious stones. I leave such fake glamour to unruly souls." Here the loud shouting that came from over near Les Halles burst out with a redoubling of bell and clamour. "What's that?" asked the child. The father replied, "Those are Saturnalia." All of a sudden, he spotted the two little ragamuffins motionless behind the little green swan house. "That is where it starts," he said. After a pause, he added, "Anarchy has entered the garden." Meanwhile, the son took a bite of the brioche, spat it out again, and started to cry. "What are you crying for?" asked the father. "I'm not hungry anymore," said the child. The father's smile grew wider. "One doesn't need to be hungry to eat a cake." "I'm sick of my cake. It's stale." "Don't you want any more?" No. The father showed him the swans. Throw it to these web-footed creatures. The child hesitated. Not wanting any more of your cake is no reason to give it away. The father went on. Be humane. We must have pity on animals. And, taking his son's cake away from him, he threw it in the pond. The cake fell fairly close to the edge. The swans were a long way off, in the middle of the pond, and busy with some prey. They had not seen the bourgeois or the brioche. The bourgeois, feeling that the cake was in danger of sinking, and stirred to action by such a pointless shipwreck, started jerking his arms as though sending signals and wound up attracting the swans' attention. They saw something floating, veered like the ships they are, and headed slowly for the brioche, with the smug majesty appropriate to white creatures. "Swans swan about," said the bourgeois, delighted at his wit. At that moment the distant tumult of the city was suddenly amplified again. This time the sound was sinister. There are gusts of wind that speak more distinctly than others. The one blowing at that moment clearly brought drum rolls, uproar, platoon fire, and the lugubrious call and answer of the tocsin and the cannon. This coincided with a black cloud that promptly hid the sun. The swans had not yet reached the brioche. "Let's go home," said the father. "They're attacking the Tuileries." He grabbed his son's hand again. Then he went on. "From the Tuileries to the Luxembourg, there is only the distance that separates royalty from the peerage. It's not far. It's going to rain musket balls." He looked at the cloud. "And perhaps it's even going to rain, too. The heavens are joining in. The younger branch is doomed. Let's go home, quick." "I wanted to see the swans eat the brioche," wailed the child. The father replied, "That would be imprudent." And he hauled away his little bourgeois. The son, regretting the swans, kept his head turned toward the pond until a flower bed hid it from him. Meanwhile, at the same time as the swans, the two little strays headed for the brioche. It was floating on the water. The little one watched the cake. The big one watched the bourgeois walking away. Father and son entered the maze of pathways that leads to the great steps by the stand of trees on the Rue Madame's side. As soon as they were no longer in sight, the elder boy swiftly lay flat on his stomach on the rounded lip of the pond and, clinging to this with his left hand, leaning over the water, close to falling in, he held his stick out toward the cake with his right hand. The swans, seeing the enemy, stepped up the pace, and in stepping up the pace, produced a kind of breastplate effect beneficial to the little fisherman. The water in front of the swans flowed back, and one of these soft concentric ripples gently pushed the brioche toward the little boy's stick. As the swans came up, the stick touched the cake. The boy gave it a quick shove, hooked in the brioche, scared off the swans, seized the cake, and straightened up. The cake was sopping wet, but they were hungry and thirsty. The elder boy broke the brioche into two pieces, a big one and a small one, took the small one for himself, and gave the big one to his brother, telling him, "There, stick that in your cake hole." Mortuus pater, filium moriturum expectat. Marius had flown out of the barricade. Combeferre had followed hard on his heels, but it was too late. Gavroche was dead. Combeferre brought the pannier of cartridges back. Marius brought the child. "Alas," he thought, "what his father did for my father, I'm doing for the son. Only Thénardier brought my father back alive. I'm bringing the boy back dead." When Marius went back into the redoubt with Gavroche in his arms, his face, like the child's, was covered in blood. Just as he had swooped down to pick Gavroche up, a bullet had grazed his skull. He had not even noticed. Courfeyrac took off his cravat and bandaged Marius's forehead with it. They laid Gavroche out on the same table as Mabeuf and spread the black shroud over the two dead bodies. It was big enough for both the old man and the child. Combeferre distributed the cartridges from the pannier that he had brought back. That gave each man 15 shots to fire. Jean Valjean was still in the same place, motionless on his curbstone. when Combeferre handed him his 15 cartridges. He shook his head. "That's a queer bird for you," Combeferre whispered to Enjolras. "He's managed to get himself into the barricade, but he doesn't want to fight."
"That doesn't stop him from defending it," retorted Enjolras.
"Heroism has its oddballs," Combeferre shot back. And Courfeyrac, who had overheard, added, "He's a different kettle of fish from old Father Mabeuf." It should be noted that the fire battering the barricade hardly disturbed the men inside it. Those who have never been through the whirlwind of this kind of war can't begin to imagine the strange moments of tranquility that are part and parcel of the convulsions. People come and go, they chat, crack jokes, sit around. Someone we know once heard a combatant say to him in the middle of a volley of grapeshot, "It's like a bachelor's picnic in here." The redoubt in the Rue de la Chanvrerie, we repeat, seemed incredibly calm inside. Every possible development, every possible phase of action, had come to an end, or was about to. The position had gone from critical to threatening, and was doubtless about to go from threatening to desperate. The grimmer the situation became, the darker the barricade glowed with the blood-red light of heroism. Enjolras gravely ruled over it, in the attitude of a young Spartan dedicating his naked blade to the dark genius Epictetus. Combeferre, with an apron tied round his waist, was tending the wounded. Bossuet and Feuilly were making cartridges using the powder horn collected by Gavroche from the dead corporal. And Bossuet was saying to Feuilly, "We'll soon be catching the coach for another planet." Courfeyrac was laying out and arranging, as carefully as a young girl tidying her little work basket, a whole arsenal of weaponry over the few cobblestones he had reserved for himself next to Enjolras. His sword stick, his musket, two horse pistols, and a handheld knuckle duster pistol. Jean Valjean was silently staring at the wall opposite. A worker was tying a broad-brimmed straw hat of Mother Hucheloup's on his head with some string, for fear of sunstroke, he said. The young men of the Cougou du Dex were nattering away gaily among themselves, as though keen to speak patois one last time. Joly, who had taken down the widow Hucheloup's mirror, was examining his tongue. A few combatants, having stumbled on some crusts of more or less moldy bread in a drawer, were wolfing them down. Marius was worrying about what his father was going to say to him. The vulture turns into the prey. There is one psychological fact peculiar to barricades that we must underline. No characteristic of this surprising street warfare should be omitted. Whatever the strange interior tranquility just mentioned, the barricade, for those who remain inside it, remains no less unreal, a hallucination. There is something of the apocalypse in civil war, with all the mists of the unknown swirling in to mingle with those savage blazes. Revolutions are sphinxes, and anyone who has lived through a barricade feels like they have lived through a dream. What you feel in those places, as we have shown with Marius, and we will see the consequences, is both larger and smaller than life. Once out of a barricade, you no longer have any idea what you saw there. You did terrible things, but you don't remember. You were surrounded by conflicting ideas that had human faces, but your head was in the light of the future. There were corpses lying prone and phantoms on their feet. The passing hours were colossal and felt like the hours of eternity. You lived in death. Shadows passed. What were they? You saw hands with blood on them. There was an unbearable deafening. There was also a terrible silence. There were open mouths shouting and other open mouths that kept quiet. You were in smoke, in the darkness, perhaps. You think you felt the sinister ooze of unknown depths. You look at something red you have under your fingernails. You don't remember anymore. Let's get back to the Rue de la Chanvrerie. All of a sudden, between two shots, they heard the distant sound of the hour striking.
"Midday," said Combeferre.
The 12 strokes had not finished sounding when Enjolras sprang straight to his feet and yelled from the top of the barricade in a voice of thunder,
Take cobblestones up into the house. Line the downstairs and attic windowsills with them. Half the men on the muskets, the other half on the cobblestones. Not a minute to lose.
A platoon of sappers, axes over their shoulders, had just appeared in battle order at the end of the street. This could only be the head of a column. And what column was it? The attacking column, obviously, the sappers charged with demolishing the barricade, having always to precede the soldiers charged with scaling it. They were obviously coming to the moment that Monsieur de Clermont-Tonnerre in 1822 called the choker trick. Enjolras' order was executed with the due haste peculiar to ships and barricades, the only two places of combat where escape is impossible. In less than a minute, two-thirds of the cobblestones that Enjolras had piled at the door of Corinthe had been taken up to the first floor in the attic. And before another minute had passed, these cobblestones, artistically packed one on top of the other, walled up half the height of the window on the first floor as well as the dormer windows in the roof. A few gaps, carefully arranged at intervals by Feuilly, the chief builder, would allow the muzzles of the muskets to pass through. This arming of the windows was all the easier to do as the grapeshot had ceased. The two field guns were now firing cannonballs at the middle of the roadblock to make a hole in it and, if possible, a breach for the assault. When the cobbles destined for the final defense were in place, Enjolras had them carry up to the first floor the bottles he had placed under the table where Mabeuf lay. "So who's going to drink that?" Bossuet asked him. "They are," said Enjolras. Then they barricaded the window downstairs, and they held at the ready the iron crossbars that served to bar the tavern door from the inside at night. The fortress was complete. The barricade was the rampart, the tavern was the keep. With the remaining cobblestones, they blocked up the opening. As defenders of a barricade are always obliged to stint on their ammunition, and the besiegers know this, the besiegers go about putting the finishing touches on their arrangements with a sort of irritating leisureliness, exposing themselves prematurely to fire, though more in appearance than in reality, and making themselves comfortable. Preparations for attack are always made with a certain methodical slowness, after which all hell breaks loose. This slow pace allowed Enjolras to review everything and perfect everything. He felt that since men like these were to die, their death should be a masterpiece. He said to Marius, "We are the two leaders. I'm going to give the last orders inside. You stay outside and keep watch." Marius posted himself to keep watch on the crest of the barricade. Enjolras had the door to the kitchen, which, as you will recall, was now the field hospital, nailed up. "So the wounded won't get spattered," he said. He gave his final instructions in the downstairs room, in a voice that was clipped, but profoundly calm. Feuilly listened and answered on everyone's behalf. "On the first floor, hold your axes ready to cut off the staircase. Have you got them?" "Yes," said Feuilly. "How many?" "Two axes and a poleaxe." "Good. There are 26 of us combatants left standing. How many muskets are there?"
34.
8 too many. Keep the 8 guns loaded like the rest and at hand. Swords and pistols at your belts. 20 men at the barricade, 6 in ambush at the attic windows and the window on the first floor to open fire on the assailants through the loopholes in the cobblestones. Let not a single useless worker remain here. Shortly, when the drum beats the charge, let the 20 from below rush the barricade. The first men in will get the best places." These provisions made, he turned to Javert and said to him, "I haven't forgotten you." And placing a pistol on the table, he added, "The last one out of here will put a bullet in this spy's skull." "Here?" asked a voice. "No, let's not mix his corpse up with ours. You can climb over the small barricade in Mondétour Lane. It's only 4 feet high. The man's well trussed up. You will take him there, and you will execute him there." Only one man, at that moment, was even more imperturbable than Enjolras. It was Javert. Here Jean Valjean appeared. He had been mixed up with the group of insurgents. He stepped away from them and said to Enjolras,
"You are the commander?"
"Yes."
"You thanked me a moment ago."
"In the name of the Republic. The barricade has two saviors, Marius Pontmercy and you."
"Do you think I deserve a reward?"
"Of course."
"All right, then. I'm asking for one."
"What?"
"To blow that man's brains out myself."
Javert raised his head, saw Jean Valjean, gave an imperceptible nod, and said,
"That is only right."
As for Enjolras, he had started to reload his carbine. He cast his eyes around him.
"Any complaints?"
And he turned to Jean Valjean.
"Take the snitch."
Jean Valjean did, in fact, take possession of Javert by plunking himself down on the end of the table. He grabbed the pistol, and a faint clicking sound announced that he had cocked it. Almost at the same moment, a bugle call was heard.
"En garde!"
cried Marius from the top of the barricade. Javert started to laugh, with that noiseless laugh peculiar to him, and staring hard at the insurgents, he said to them,
"You're hardly any better off than I am." "Everyone outside!"
cried Enjolras. The insurgents leaped outside in an uproar, and as they left, were stabbed in the back, if you'll forgive the expression, by these words of Javert's,
"See you soon!"
Jean Valjean gets his revenge. When Jean Valjean was alone with Javert, he undid the rope that held the prisoner secure around the waist, the knot of which was under the table. Then he signaled to him to get up. Javert did as he was told, but with that indefinable smile in which the supremacy of shackled authority is condensed. Jean Valjean seized Javert by the martingale as you would grab a beast of burden by the breast strap, and, dragging him after him, walked out of the tavern slowly, for Javert, hobbled to the legs, could only take very small steps. Jean Valjean had his pistol in his fist. They went through the trapeze formed by the inside of the barricade like this. The insurgents, all geared up for the imminent attack, had their backs turned. Marius alone, positioned at the left end of the roadblock, saw them go by. This pair, formed by the victim and the executioner, was lit up for him by the sepulchral light in his soul. Jean Valjean made Javert climb over the small entrenchment of Mondétour Lane, which he did with some difficulty, trussed up as he was, though he did not let go of him for a single instant. When they had climbed over this little roadblock, they found themselves alone together in the lane. No one could see them now. The elbow made by the houses hid them from the insurgents. The corpses removed from the barricade made a terrible mound a few feet away. You could make out in the heap of the dead a livid face, hair flowing down, a hand shot through, and a half-bared woman's breast. That was Éponine. Javert looked sideways at the dead woman and, profoundly calm, said in an undertone, "It seems to me I know that girl." Then he turned to Jean Valjean. Jean Valjean stuck his pistol under his arm and leveled a look at Javert that needed no words to say, "Javert, it's me." Javert answered, "Take your revenge." Jean Valjean pulled a knife out of his fob pocket and flicked it open.
"A pig sticker," cried Javert. "You're right. That's more your style."
Jean Valjean cut the martingale yoked around Javert's neck. Then he cut the ropes around his wrists. Then, bending down, he cut the string around his feet. And, straightening up again, he said to him, "You are free." Javert was not easily amazed. Yet, completely in control of himself as he was, he could not escape a surge of inner turmoil. He stood stock still, mouth agape. Jean Valjean elaborated, "I don't think I'll be getting out of here alive. But if by chance I do get out, I go by the name of Fauchelevent, Rue de l'Homme Armé, number 7. Javert gave a tiger's scowl that pulled up the corners of his mouth, and he snarled between clenched teeth,
"Watch out!"
"Off you go," said Jean Valjean. Javert went on,
"You said Fauchelevent, Rue de l'Homme Armé,
number 7. Javert repeated to himself,
"Number 7.
He buttoned up his overcoat again, put some military stiffness back between his shoulder blades, did a half-turn, folded his arms, supporting his chin with one hand, and began to walk in the direction of Le Halle. Jean Valjean watched him go. After a few steps, Javert turned round and shouted at Jean Valjean,
"I don't like this. Kill me instead, why don't you?"
Javert himself did not notice, that he no longer addressed Jean Valjean with the familiarity of contempt.
"Keep going," said Jean Valjean.
Javert walked very slowly away. A moment later he turned the corner of the Rue des Prêcheurs. When Javert had disappeared, Jean Valjean fired the pistol in the air. Then he returned to the barricade and said, "Done." Meanwhile, what had happened is this. Marius, busier with the outside than the inside, had not till then looked too closely at the spy tied up in the dark at the back of the downstairs room. When he saw him in broad daylight, clambering over the barricade to go to his death, he recognized him. A memory suddenly sprang to mind. He remembered the inspector of the Rue de Pontoise and the two pistols he had given him, which he, Marius, had used in this very barricade. And he not only remembered the face, but he remembered the name. This recollection, though, was hazy and confused, like everything going on in his mind. It was not a statement he put to himself, but a question. "Isn't that the inspector of police who told me his name was Javert?" Perhaps there was still time to intervene on the man's behalf. But he had to know, first of all, if it really was Javert. Marius called out to Enjolras, who had just positioned himself at the other end of the barricade.
"Enjolras!"
"What?"
"What's the name of that man?"
"Who?"
"The police officer. Do you know his name?"
"Naturally, he told us himself.
So what's his name?"
"Javert." Marius straightened up. At that moment, the pistol shot was heard. Jean Valjean reappeared and cried out, "Done." A dark chill ran through Marius's heart. The dead are right, but the living are not wrong. The barricade's death throes were about to begin. Everything concurred in the tragic majesty of this supreme moment. A thousand mysterious roaring sounds in the air, the breath of the armed masses set in motion in streets that could not be seen, the intermittent galloping of cavalry, the heavy rattling of artillery on the move, platoon fire and cannon fire crossing each other in the labyrinth of Paris, the smoke from the battle rising all golden above the rooftops, unidentifiable, vaguely terrible cries in the distance, lightning flashes of menace everywhere, the tocsin of Saint-Marie that now sounded like sobbing, the sweetness of the season, the splendor of the sky full of sun and clouds, the beauty of the day, and the appalling silence of the houses. For since the night before, the two rows of houses of the Rue de la Chanvrerie had become two great walls, staunchly savage walls, doors shut, windows shut, shutters shut. In those days, so different from our own, when the people finally felt the time had come to have done either with a situation that had gone on too long, or with a charter granted or some piece of law, when universal anger had spread throughout the atmosphere, when the city consented to the pulling up of its pavements, when insurrection made the bourgeoisie smile by whispering its watchword in its ear, then the ordinary householder, immersed in rioting, so to speak, was the auxiliary of the combatant, and the house fraternized with the improvised fortress that leaned on it. When the situation was not ripe, when insurrection was decidedly not agreed to, when the masses disowned the movement, then that was it for the combatants. The city turned into a desert around the revolt. Hearts and minds frosted over. Refuges were walled off, and the street turned itself into a defile to assist the army in taking the barricade. You can't shock a people into going any faster than they want to go. Woe betide the man who tries to force their hand. A people won't let themselves be pushed around. They will just abandon an insurrection to its own devices. The insurgents become lepers. A house is a cliff face. A door is rejection. A facade is a wall. The wall sees, hears, and will have none of it. It could crack open a bit and save you, but no. The wall is a judge. It looks at you and condemns you. What a grim sight these closed houses are. They look dead, but they are alive. Life, which seems to be suspended there, goes on inside just the same. No one has come out for 24 hours, but they are all in there. On the inside of that solid rock, they come and go to bed, get up. They are one happy family in there. They eat in there and they drink. They are frightened in there, too, which is a terrible thing. Fear excuses such terrible inhospitality. It merges with alarm, an extenuating circumstance. Sometimes, and this has been seen, fear even becomes a passion. Fright can turn to fury just as prudence can turn to rage. Hence the very profound expression, moderate extremists. There are flare-ups of utter terror from which rage issues like gloomy smoke. What do these people want? They're never satisfied. They compromise men of peace. As if we haven't had enough revolutions as it is. What have they come here for? Let them get themselves out of it. Too bad for them. It's their own fault. They've only got what they had coming to them. It's nothing to do with us. Look at our poor street riddled with bullets. They're a bunch of vermin. Whatever you do, don't open the door. And the house takes on the look of a tomb. The insurgent at the door is about to die. He sees the grapeshot and the drawn sabers coming. If he cries out, he knows that they can hear him, but that no one will come. There are walls there that could protect him. There are men there who could save him, and the walls have ears of flesh, and the men have hearts of stone. Who is to blame? No one and everyone. The imperfect times in which we live. It is always at its own risk that a utopia transforms itself into an insurrection and goes from a philosophical protest to an armed protest, turning from Minerva to Pallas. The utopia that gets impatient and turns into a riot knows what awaits it. It almost always arrives too soon. So it resigns itself and stoically accepts disaster in a place of triumph. It serves those who denounce it without complaining, even exonerating them, and its magnanimity lies in agreeing to desertion. It is indomitable in the face of any obstacle, yet easy on ingratitude. Is it ingratitude, though? Yes, from the standpoint of the human race. No, from the standpoint of the individual. Progress is mankind's modus vivendi. Progress is the name we give to the regular life of the human race. Progress is the name we give to the collective step the human race takes. Progress marches onward. It makes the great human and earthly journey toward the heavenly and the divine. It has its halts where it rallies the flock lagging behind. It has its stops where it meditates beside some splendid Canaan that suddenly unveils its promised land. It has its nights where it sleeps. And one of the poignant preoccupations of the thinker is to see shadow over the human soul and to grope around in the dark without being able to wake dozing progress up. Maybe God is dead, Gérard du Nerval said one day to the writer of these lines, confusing God with progress and taking the interruption in movement for the death of the supreme being. Whoever despairs is wrong. Progress invariably wakes up and has always marched on, so to speak, even as it dozes, for it has grown. When we see it on its feet again, we find it taller. To be always peaceful is no more the province of progress than of a river. Don't throw up a dam there, don't throw in a rock. Any obstruction makes the water roil and makes humanity boil over. This produces turmoil, but after such turmoil, we recognize that a certain amount of ground has been covered. Until order, which is simply universal peace, is established, until harmony and unity reign, progress will have revolutions as stopovers along the way. So what is progress? We just said, the continuous life of peoples. Now it sometimes happens that the momentary life of individuals puts up some resistance to the eternal life of the human race. Let's admit without bitterness that the individual has his own distinct self-interest, and can, without committing a crime, make that interest clear and defend it. The present has its excusable dose of egotism. The life of the moment has its rights and is not bound to sacrifice itself endlessly to the future. The generation currently taking its turn on this earth is not obliged to shorten